I know that Irving Pollock started the division, and Irving was very good. He was a nuts and bolts guy. But he didn't have Stanley's vision or scope. Or initiative. By the way, is he still around?
He is.
Don't tell him I said so. I may take that back in the editing. No, I like him. But Stanley, you know, Stanley really understood what had to be done. Stanley understood the need for the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Irving might have understood the need for it and not exactly put it all together. Stanley is very creative. Stanley is also... I had a lot of fun with him because Stanley at least had a sense of humor to him. You know, he was able periodically to pull him up short and say, you know, Stanley, you're doing a great job, but we still have a constitution in this country. Still got due process in this country, Stanley. Back off for a minute and think of what you're saying and what you're doing, you know. And he would look at me and say, really, really, you think I'm going too far? And we would have a great dialogue. Did I get away with anything? No. That I shouldn't have gotten away with, I should say. But it was just wonderful to deal with the guy, to deal with a number of his assistant directors and branch chiefs.
Do you recall their names?
Excuse me?
Do you recall their names?
Well, Ted Levine, I guess, was one of them. Just wondering. But I can't really recall their names. Because they were all afraid of him. You know, you would try to make a deal on something with a branch chief or an assistant director, and they'd say, well, Stanley will never approve of it. And I would say, well, how do you know? Let's talk to him. They'd go, well, let me talk to him. How do you get to see him? I said, well, I'll call him. We'll get an appointment. Well, maybe you can get an appointment. I can't get an appointment. Staff was very frightened of him. That was his one drawback. That he micromanaged on the one hand. On the other hand, he did not. He was not very collegial with the staff. But nobody in this world, in my respect, more in the field of law enforcement, in securities law enforcement, than Stanley's portrait.
Do you recall having a view as to the formation of the Division of Enforcement, taking the enforcement from in the various divisions and putting it into one division?
Yes, I think that was Irving Pollack's idea, and it was a useful idea. Because under the prior arrangement, nobody was taking the enforcement very seriously. Nobody was developing a set of principles. Nobody was developing a coordinated point of view. Now, was that done under Kerry?
No, was that under Casey?
Hmm?
Bill Casey?
No, you had an enforcement division before Bill Casey.
No, it was Bill Casey.
1972.
Okay. But it was still Irving's?
Yes.
Yeah, Kerry professed an interest in enforcement. Okay. Is Kerry still alive?
No, passed away a number of years ago. How old, did you know Kerry well?
Yeah. He was... Godspanning professors. Kerry was one of these people who, he had a theoretical view of corporations and how they function and knew what the fiduciary obligations of the directors are and what an auditor should and shouldn't do. And he was interested in law enforcement, and he was interested in making criminal cases. But there's nothing worse than a in a position like that, in my view, than somebody who professes rectitude and will not tolerate ex-party communications or political interference, and then does.
Did he really?
Yes. I mean, no, this is what I resented.
Mm-hmm.
The Hazel Bishop case, who was chairman at that time?
That was Kerry.
Okay. When I tried to resolve the Hazel Bishop case, and I wanted to talk to him about it, he wouldn't see me. I'd known him. Wouldn't see me. And then when I did resolve it with Manny, Ben Javits, whose firm was general counsel to Hazel Bishop, A, resented the fact that I was able to find a solution, and B, that they were going to have to enter into all these agreements. So he got his brother to go see Kerry and came back to advise the board of directors that it probably could be worked out with Kerry without the strenuous imposition that I'd worked out with Manny. And I was furious. And it was not uncharacteristic of Kerry looking, you know, in his dealings with the Congress, and he was an amateur. I found out when I was in government, I worked in the executive branch for a short period of time. I worked on the Hill for a short period of time. If you understand that politicians have to make representations, and you don't have to give in to them, because they have to make representations, that's fine. But the people who were most resentful of political interference were the people who didn't understand that and thought that every time a congressman or a senator called or wrote, that he meant it, or that he had to do something. And they used to drive me crazy, both working on the Hill, you know, and when I wrote some of those letters for a congressman and working in the executive branch, when I get some of those letters. And Kerry was one of these people who didn't understand that. He was naive. Guys like Casey would understand it. Guys like Kennedy would understand it. And guys like Kennedy and Casey would never resent political interference because they know how to deal with it. And I think it's true of people who develop a reputation in a different career. Not that being a professor of law at Columbia is not a career, but I don't think Wheat ever understood that. I think Donaldson does, from what I can see. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, I was always under the impression that Landis had sort of selected Kerry as well. That Landis had originally tried to talk Louis Lawson to becoming chairman. Lawson turned it down, and then he chose Kerry.
Well, no. Landis tried to talk Lawson to it, yes, and he tried to talk Edmund Levy into it. And he turned it down. And then he tried to talk me into it. Not too vigorously, I should say. But does the name Sam Harris mean anything?
No.
Sam Harris was a partner in what is now known, was then known as Freed Frank.
Mm-hmm.
Was a Free Frank Harris Schreiber.
Kaplan or something.
Yeah, well, the Washington office became Kaplan. And Sam Harris wanted me to go move down to Washington with Kaplan. Was Max was just coming out of Humphrey's office, and he wanted the two of us to join the Free Frank office in Washington, thinking that we could revitalize it. Up to then, it had been run by Felix Cohen, whose claim to fame was that he handled Indian claims with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And so that office was nothing much to speak of, and so he wanted me to come into it and wanted Max to come into it. And at that point I said to him, I didn't think I wanted to do it. Because I was thinking about going to the commission. And I'll never forget, he said to me, "Really? And what are you going to do there?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Unless you have an independent reputation, such as a Joe Kennedy or a Dean Landis, the best you are is a caretaker, and you'll end up with an epitaph that says he was a chairman of the SEC. And somebody will say, 'And how many chairmen were there?' And somebody will say, 14, 15, 16. He said, "Don't do it." And I didn't. Carey was suggested actually by Lou Harris, the pollster, who was his next door neighbor in Riverdale, and who was Kennedy's pollster. And Landis went along with it, but he was not Carey. Carey was not his original choice. Edmund Levy, who later became Attorney General, was his original choice. What else do you want to cover?
Oh, we have lots to cover. Why don't we talk a little bit more about a couple of your cases, and then let's talk some more about Landis?
Yes.
Well, I'm really interested in learning more about the Vesco case.
Okay. You talk about the Vesco case.
Or the Cornfield case. Cornfield case, if you prefer.
Or Crazy Eddie.
Crazy Eddie. October 1972, the commission brought the Vesco case, alleging that he had stolen $224 million and seeking a preliminary injunction. And they named as defendants all of the management companies, all of the fund companies, I believe Arthur Anderson, one of the associates at Wilkie Farr. You already have the caption there. Whole bunch of people. The case started, I think, in some measure because of the talk by this lawyer in New Jersey that about the $200,000 in cash in the suitcase at Vesco. No, I guess there was an investigation of Vesco going on before that, when the $200,000 went to the campaign fund in 72. But in any event, the staff named, in my judgment, too many defendants. Because the net result was that Arthur Lyman, who was representing Vesco personally and had been in the course of the early stages of the investigation, and for some reason they moved, I think they moved pretty surely, but in any event, He put together what we came to call the Robert Vesco Bar, Robert Vesco Bar Association. He brought me into it to represent the management companies. And I brought with me my partner and friend, Paul Grand, who's now in the Regas case.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Timothy Regas, who was a classmate of your father's at law school.
At Columbia.
Right?
Yeah.
And who introduced me to your father originally. I don't have a list of the defendants.
If you look at down the bottom right-hand corner, it's the counsel.
Okay.
But it doesn't identify who they're representing.
It doesn't identify who they're representing, but on the next page, it identifies the defendants or some of the defendants.
Right. Well, I had the management companies. Arthur had Vesco. Dornbusch, Mensch had Ted O had financial officer. John Martin, who later became a district judge, had some of the defendants. Alan Schwartz, who later became a district judge, had some of the other defendants. You had a lineup of defense lawyers, which I think is the cream of the securities white collar crime bar, securities enforcement white collar crime bar in the city, against Howard Kushner, and he had one young guy with him. Who was it?
Blank? Alan Blank?
Alan Blank. And initially we had Joe Flom in it. I mean, we had everybody.
You know, IOC is probably, I'm not sure Dan was born then. Maybe you should explain what IOC was all about.
Oh, okay. IOS,
I'm sorry.
What it was is that Kornfeld, after the war, set up something called the Fund of Funds. And what he did was he sold in Europe and in Latin America. And that was the basic structure. He had several other arrangements, but he sold interest in the Fund of Funds, which invested only in other funds. So he had very little overhead. He had a bunch of salesmen, and they were selling mostly to American servicemen overseas. And the management companies were all foreign entities. There was virtually no contact with the United States, except that these funds that they were selling, that they were investing in, were American entities. And he did very, very well. And he came, Vesco ran a little company in New Jersey called International Controls, I believe. And somehow or other hooked up with a guy named Alan Butler from the Bahamas, who was on the board of IOS. I mean, my memory's a little vague on all this now. Although I just noticed I had my brief since now. Vesco took over or bought from Kornfeld these management companies and the fund operations. he found that in sending out proxy statements, I mean, this is really what happened, found in sending out proxy statements that he was getting a lot of them back. And what was happening was that his salesmen all over the place were selling to foreign entities who were using money that they wanted to hide in Switzerland. And in numbered accounts, and nobody knew who the hell the owners, the real owners were. So he had what he thought was a great idea. And it was. And he had it devised by Wilkie Farr and Arthur Anderson and a couple of other law firms, and they were going to, what they were going to do was, I mean, because all of these funds were, you know, they were open-end funds, that he was going to offer everybody immediate buyouts at net asset value. And to the extent that anybody did not respond, he would then put these funds into a closed-end fund and give them shares or register shares in their name in the closed-end fund, and he would run the closed-end fund. And the plan was ABC. One, you redeem the shares. B, you offer a redemption, you redeem the shares, you set up a closed-end fund. And he had it all figured out that there was roughly about $225 million of these funds. People weren't going to show up. Year after year, they weren't voting the proxy statements, they weren't taking the dividends, they weren't. They were probably black market operators in Latin America and all over the world. And that was great. Problem was, he got impatient. As he put it, with the lawyers and the accountants were screwing them by taking too long. So instead of ABC and ending up with their $225 million, he did CBA. He started with the $225 million by investing it in related transactions, the transactions to which he was related. And so the proceedings started. And it, by the luck of the draw, it went to first Judge Lasker, who immediately passed it on to a newly appointed judge, Stewart. And Stewart was just overwhelmed. I mean, we had an evidentiary hearing on a preliminary injunction that, as I recall, lasted 8 months.
Had Vesco left the country yet?
In the course of which he left the country. It started out, I'll never forget the first time we went to, we had 14 lawyers, among whom I named, who went on to Vesco's privately owned 707 at Newark Airport. And it was set up with a discotheque in back. And it had six seats up front, Fresco and his family, and then a lounge for the rest of us with a stewardess in hot pants who was married to the pilot who was named Eisenhower, but I don't think it was recorded. And when we took off, Donald Nixon, president's nephew, right, this is 1972, passed through the cabin to offer us cigars, Cuban cigars. And I said, I'm not saying to him, where do you get these? He says, oh, we buy them in the Bahamas. We all decided we were going to have the meeting in the Bahamas. Arthur Lyman decided we were going to have a meeting in the Bahamas. And so we weren't going to talk about the case in the meeting in the Bahamas. So I said, you're handing these out at Newark Airport. He said, the customs people all know who I am. He was the president's nephew. Yeah. They don't search my baggage. You want whatever you want to buy, you just and they I'll bring it and give it to you later. But that was the spirit of the thing. Anyway, we must have had 8 or 10 meetings in the Bahamas. We met in London. We met in Paris. We were all over the world on this case. And for a while, it looked as though that injunction was going to be denied. And it wasn't until the judge was mandamus and the Second Circuit excoriated that the case and let's go abscond. During the course of the case, more darn things happened. There was the Sunday, or there was the weekend when Vesco 40 wanted to settle. When Arthur Lyman and I called Stanley and Irving and came to New York, about a half a dozen of us had lunch, and we thought we'd worked out a deal. It would involve a criminal plea, but a cooperation agreement, and Vesco reneged on it. He had indicated that he wanted to make a deal.
Was he just stalling for time until he could get the money out of the country?
Oh, the money was out of the country. The money was out of the country.
At that time, did you know about the campaign contributions too?
By that time, we knew about the campaign contributions because that was one of the elements of the case. And by that time, Stans and Mitchell had been indicted, and Peter Fleming was trying that case at the same time we were trying the injunction case in the same courthouse. The money had gone out of the country in a number of ways. And for instance, when we tried to show, transactions were legitimate. If you bought the Bahamas, what was it called, the Bahamas something bank, and we tried to show that the bank had not been looted, and we brought some auditors down. I took to go through. We were going through transactions, and I found a $500,000 mortgage to a bakery, a little bakery up in the Native Quarter. Bob, what's this about? Hold on, here, one minute. it was a mortgage on a little bakery that was owned by the Prime Minister's mother. He had invested in a farm in Costa Rica that belonged to the president. The money was out of the country. There's no question about that. The question was whether he would bring it back and what would be done with it, and that was to form the basis of the framework of a settlement. But there came a time when he said he wasn't coming back, and that's when we walked away from it. But in the meanwhile, in the meanwhile, we had that famous, one of my clients got arrested in
Luxembourg.
Because
Kornfeld ultimately went to jail in Switzerland, didn't he?
Kornfeld went to jail in Switzerland for a period of time. Yeah. Switzerland, you go to jail first. They try you later. He actually got out of it later.
But Kornfeld always claimed that he knew nothing about what Fesco was doing.
I think that's probably true. I would say I never saw any indication otherwise. But, you know, crazy things happened in that case. For instance, some of the money was in Luxembourg. One of the management companies was a Luxembourg company. The banking superintendent of Luxembourg wanted to examine Bud Meisner on some of these issues, president of the Luxembourg company. We all met in London and decided that we couldn't bring him into Luxembourg without some understanding that he wasn't going to be arrested. And my partner, George Solomon, wonderful, wonderful lawyer and a great human being, died a year or so ago, who had been Landis' associate when I joined forces, went to Luxembourg, hired counsel. They met with Don Dollinger, the banking superintendent of banks, banking commissioner, who guaranteed us all safe passage while we would negotiate a settlement in Luxembourg. We left from London, we went to Luxembourg, spent the night, and in the morning while having breakfast, Meisner was arrested. And when we went to the meeting in Gondolino's office to protest it, who was there? Irving Pollack. Irving Pollack, Bernie Cederbaum, his wife is now a district judge, who was counsel to the receiver, because there was a temporary receiver appointed. The receiver, a couple of other people from the commission staff, and it all fell apart. And Meisner did some time in the Luxembourg jail before we got him out.
That must have been really unusual. In those days, the SEC didn't do much with foreign regulators, did it?
No, but this case stuck in everybody's craw, and it might well have. And Vesco was flaunting it. We tried to get him to realize that he couldn't live his life out of the country, and he wouldn't believe it. So,
did we hear from him?
Excuse me.
He's still allegedly in Cuba, isn't he?
He's allegedly in Cuba. No, I have not heard from him. The last time we but he did all kinds of things. You know, for instance, we insisted that before we made an offer on behalf of one of the companies to settle, we had to have a corporate resolution. So we had a meeting of the board of directors in Nassau. And three cab drivers from Mexico City came in. They were directors. And George Solomon and I and Calvin Cobb of Steptoe and Johnson explained the transaction to the interpreter. All complicated proposal for settlement. And translator said five words, and the Fesco said, "Are you ready to vote?" And I said, "Si." Did we have a board of directors meeting? Did we not have a board of directors
meeting? Sounds like good corporate governance.
But that's, you know, there were a lot of amusing stories involved in the Fesco case. But it was an experience. Switzerland, France. Of course, the German shareholders retained Morgan Lewis and Packers, and they came into it with a, of course, somebody got smart and got a Canadian government to appoint a receiver, because these were mostly Canadian companies. Cool. So, anyway, the Vesco case was a most unusual one.
Do you want to, Dan was just saying, do you want to take a few minutes break? Or
I'm fine. You want to take a break? You want to have something more to eat? You want a cup of coffee? Whatever.
It's fine. All right. Well, do you want to talk for a few minutes about Crazy Eddie, too?
Sure.
As long as we're talking about scoundrels.
He's a delightful scoundrel. Most of these scoundrels are delightful. I'll tell you that. I think Eddie retained me. Since come to learn and told him, mostly because of the Vesco case. I think he thought that Vesco, having managed to get away with it and not having to come back, that he could too. But Eddie was. What do we want to say about the Crazy Eddie case? The Crazy Eddie case, as you know...
When did you get involved? During the investigation, or were you involved at all in the offerings?
No. Paul Weiss handled the offering. No, we got involved during the investigation. His cousin, Solomon Antar, came to see me and said that Eddie was considering retaining us. And he interviewed me. And called Eddie, and Eddie showed up in the office. And these guys always have, for the most part, they always have stories that sound right. And for a while, everybody was hanging tight in that case.
What was this? What was their story? Because the facts of the case were that this was huge phony inventory scheme and phony receivables that they were inventing every night.
Well, the same store, it turned out that the real issue was the so-called same store sales. Mm-hmm. It turned out that when they wanted to go public, at least this was then proven in the case, when they wanted to go public, one of the issues that the commission wanted disclosed in the registration statement, and they aborted one statement, one registration, withdrew it and came in the following year, was whether or not the opening of all of these new stores was in any way affecting the sales in the existing stores, so that this expansion that was enormous, whether this enormous expansion was cannibalizing the property. Well, as it turned out, what had happened is that they were draining off the cash over the years and had deposited the cash in Israel, some $75 million worth, it turned out. And when they needed same-store sales, they were bringing back the cash and running the cash through the registers in the old stores without necessarily having sales to show great receipts. That was the fraud. The tax fraud was something else. I mean, they were draining cash all along. And the inventories was another story. They would ship. They would get the suppliers just before the annual inventory to ship stuff.
Attention.
The inventory story was very simple. They would order goods, merchandise, knowing that there was an inventory to be taken. They wouldn't pay for it. They would take it on consignment. The inventory would be there for the purposes of the audit. They sent it back. Or not pay for it.
Well, when you got involved in the case, how much of this did you, were you aware of? How did it play out? Because it was a massive, it was one of the largest frauds of the time.
It played out with gradually the family breaking up in disputes. The big issue became Eddie had a wife and five children, and Eddie took up with a young woman who was working there. And on New Year's Eve, a particular time, he failed to show up for his family's home. It was a very close Sephardic Jewish family. And his father and his wife and two of his brothers raided the mistress's apartment, found him there. And that started a fight. And he then supposedly got a divorce from his wife. He had a cousin of his represent her in the divorce, theoretically, and he had another lawyer representing him, and it was a consent divorce. And she didn't know she was divorced. And the cousin had a so-called retainer agreement when she brought an action for support, and there was a judgment of divorce that had terms of support. It turned out that the cousin, who was the lawyer, had a retainer agreement. She was represented by Raoul Felder's wife, big famous divorce lawyer, and it turned out that the retainer agreement, I did not represent Eddie in that proceeding, but it turned out that the retainer agreement was on his stationery, the lawyer Solomon's Anton, the lawyer's cousin's stationery, which had a 718 area code, which did not exist as of that date. And that started things unraveling.
It's a very famous story within the Division of Enforcement.
Really?
Yes, it is. That story is told many times.
Simpson's still there?
Yeah, Rick Simpson. It's viewed as one of the great pieces of detective work to determine that the area code had not come into existence yet at the time of the order.
Yeah. And it started unraveling everything. And then one cousin started taking this position, another cousin started taking that position, and the deals were being made. And
did you still represent him when he was finally picked up? The famous story about, you know, the duct tape and the cash around his body. Yeah. Well, no. When he was finally picked up in Israel?
We went down there. My partner Bill Schwartz and I went down there along with Jack Arsenal. Well, first Bill went down with Arsenal. I didn't go down until the second time around on the extradition proceeding. And Bill Schwartz went down on the bail proceeding. He got picked up because what happened was that he went to Switzerland to try to get money out of a bank, and which he claimed was a different name, and he who tried it. You know, he said he had sold some diamonds to somebody, and the guy gave him, signed a bank account, the bank figured out who he was and tracked him down. But when on a bail hearing in Israel, they produced the Panamanian passport, the Argentinian passport, the Brazilian passport, seven passports.
And when he was arrested, he had duct taped the cash around his body.
Really?
Yeah.
He had lived in it with a taxi driver somewhere, in an apartment somewhere. I dumped him essentially when he disappeared. Of course, I counseled him to meet me that day in the courtroom, and he disappeared. He didn't show up. So I was through with him. But then when he got picked up, and I didn't hear from him while he was away, but then he got picked up and he called us.